Mame Warren, this is tape two with Park Rouse on December 15th, 1996. My last couple of questions. Did you get out into the country much? Did you get out to Goshen or House Mountain?
Yeah, one of the nice things about Lexington, we thought, was the surrounding area. Some of us would go out and camp all night on House Mountain. I remember once going with a guy named Morton Brown from Louisville and a guy named Jim Andrews from Norfolk and somebody else, I can't remember, but we built a fire and cooked our dinner and sat around and gas and had a little beer and then we tried to go to sleep, but it was cold and we were, bed packs were borrowed from somebody. They were awful with it. They didn't give you any softness, and we couldn't sleep. I began to think about the Wildcats. We kept the fire going, the embers of the fire, so we'd have it in the morning. And then I remembered that I'd read that Wildcats weren't attracted by fire, but it was a very unpleasant experience. I think we did it two or three times. In the summertime, we'd go down and swim in Goshen Pass, but the water was hideously cold. I was a tidewater person, used to water temperatures about 78 or 80 degrees, which is comfortable, but up there, the water in Goshen Pass was always impossible. Marshall Peenick had a racehorse. It was a son of it was one of a family of horses that had been sired by Sunbow, Sunbeau, and Dr. Lee, Bowling Lee, who was a grandson of Robert E. Lee. He was a physician in New York City at a fairly well-to-do man. Dr. Bowling Lee was given this racehorse by somebody, and he in turn gave it to Mr. Peenick. But Dr. Lee was on the board of Washington Lee, and so he gave this little colt to Mr. Peenick. And Marshall used to go out in the country where she boarded the colt and take friends to feed the pony, the little horse, sugar cubes. And we went out, Lewis McBurn and I, one Sunday after she had taught her class at the little Presbyterian chapel at House Mountain. We went out to feed the horse, and there was another colt of a common variety in the stable with him, because he said it made a thoroughbred horse more amenable to being trained if you had it with another horse in the same pen. But when Marshall tried to feed her horse sugar, the other horse came up and bit her on the bosom, and it was a crisis because she was a young lady and we were two young men, and we couldn't do but so much under the... We rushed her back to town where she saw Dr. Reed White. Dr. Reed White pronounced the damage to be superficial. But we used to go out with Marshall occasionally to see her horse. Occasionally when theater events would occur in Richmond, some of us would rent a car and go down. One year, Francis Lederer was performing in a play by S.N. Bierman. Can't remember the name of the play. It was a very successful play of its time. It was being done in Richmond. And four of us rented this car, and we, believe it or not, we had four flat tires coming back. We got there in time to see the play, and then as soon as it was over, we started home. But first one tie and then the next, the car was old and the tires were terrible. And so the last time we had no, we had given out of all the material you used to repair blowouts. So we just had to leave the car at Amherst and get a taxi to take us to Lexington.
Oh my God.
To try to get to class on time. But and then there were a lot, I'd go over to Hollins occasionally. Once I went to Hollins, and the girl I was going to see was all dressed up like a boy, because at Hollins in those days, they had student dances, and they made the seniors went as girls, but all the lower classmen went as boys, dressed up as boys, and broke with the seniors and danced with them. And I said, "Good Lord, I never expect to see you like this." The girls' schools were very sniffy. One night, some of us went to Barry Baldwin, and the it was winter, the car had a lot of antifreeze in it. The antifreeze had got hot, and the fumes had come back in the car, and they were somewhat alcoholic smelling. And when we got to Barry Baldwin, Dean, she had a German name, the Dean of Women, who had to interview you when you came in for your date, she said, "You have been drinking alcohol." And we said, "No, ma'am." She said, "Well, you smell of alcohol." And we said, "That is antifreeze in the car." One of my fraternity brothers was a law student. He said, "Madam, if you persist in saying we've been drinking alcohol, I could bring a suit against you for defamation." He said, "We haven't touched, we hadn't really." But I think her name was Dean Fohl, P-F-O-H-L. And the, another one of the deans at Mary Bowen married Dr. Campbell, was the lady you saw.
Yes, was, that was Dean Fohl.
Dean Fohl, uh-huh. Okay, all right. I can't say I remember her at all, but she evidently is a very superior lady.
She was very impressive. Very impressive. And she told stories like that, so that's fun to hear the story from both sides. That's what I love about doing this. I get stories from both sides.
Oh, I don't know. The last year I was there, that Europe was beginning to go crazy, and also, I believe, while I was there, that British ditched King Edward, and the affair with Edward and Wallace Simpson was going on, and my fraternity host mother, Ms. Mead, was absolutely torn up by that. She just thought the Prince of Wales was the most wonderful guy in the world, and she we would sit in her suite in the fraternity house, listening to this thin little international broadcast, when he would talk about, "I cannot marry the woman I love," or something, "I cannot be king and with the woman I love, and so I'm going to leave." Anyways, my Lord, she cried and cried and cried. And it was terrible. I said in that little talk I made, I think that I don't think we really appreciated all the things that were happening in Germany and in Europe. We were so absorbed in ourselves at school. There's one other thing. When I was in my last year, I did a survey of the senior class that was published in the school magazine, and I asked them all these questions about what do you expect to earn and how, what do you expect to do, and it was pitiful. We all thought that we would perhaps be lucky and earn as much as $10,000 a year, because at that time the professors at W&L were making $5,000 a year, Dr. Gaines, I think his president was making something like 15 or 16,000. And the whole salary scale was so different. This was before the great leap in World War II in prices and everything. And our ambition seemed very modest. But I had a copy of that thing somewhere, and it really reflects, if you want to go that much in detail, reflects what college kids were thinking in 1937.
I'll look that up. That sounds very interesting.
The magazine is the Southern Collegian, and it would have been an issue for either 36 or 37.
Okay, I'll get that at the library. I'd like to see that. Well, what happened? You mentioned what you all thought was going to happen. What happened after college? What happened at graduation?
Oh, Dr. Gaines, as always, made the most marvelous farewell. And in those days, and I think it's still true, the president made the farewell address rather than have somebody come in from away. And Dr. Gaines started that. And I was really, all of us just really hated. My brother, who came along 2 years after me, cried all the way from Lexington to Stanton when we were going home. I'd gone up for his graduation because it was, there's something about being at that at school. Maybe other people feel the same way about their schools, but and we got out in a very poor time. I got a off of a job for $20 a week at the Daily Press in Newport News, and I talked to Tom Riegel in the journalism school. He said he thought that was about as good as most people were. That was about the starting rate for a newspaper job. So I went down there, and after 3 years, I was offered $35 by the Richmond paper, so I went on up there. But the salary scale after World War II, then suddenly really began to jump. And nowadays, newspaper reporters must make $25,000 or $30,000 a year.
So what was your first job out of?
Was as a reporter on the Newport News Daily Press.
Okay, all right, that's what I thought. Okay, well, let's jump ahead, way ahead, because one of the questions I like to find out from everyone is what your feelings are about the big change at Washington and Lee, about co-education.
Well, I... although I'm an old alumnus, I was much more prepared for coeducation than most of my contemporaries. I lived here in Williamsburg, and William and Mary was the first Virginia school to go coeducational, and it was drawing some very good students by the 1930s. And constantly increasing the level of its academic demands, and its SATs suddenly got way ahead of W&L's, and it really hurt my pride that Washington and Lee, which when I entered college had been much the superior of the two schools, was now way behind William Mary. And when Colgan Dodden became president, I liked him and knew him in Richmond on the paper. When he had become president of the University of Virginia, he reluctantly, he said he hated the idea, concluded that they ought to go co-ed, and they did. And he said, Parkin's made all the difference in the world. This is a much better institution now because the competition is much greater. The pool of applicants becomes huge, and you can pick and choose, and then once in school, the boys and the girls sort of compete for positions. And he says it's rather than upsetting the campus with rate with sexual enthusiasm. It's stabilized it because the children are. Students are living in more or less natural circumstances the way they would live anywhere, boys and girls all here together. So he said it's done great things for the University of Virginia. And I hated seeing us. We were taking some people from Williamsburg and places around that I didn't think were up to the W&L standards. In fact, W&L has always, I don't know that this needs to get in the book, always had a problem of getting the best people in Virginia, because Virginia has very good publicly supported colleges. I could have gone to, today I could go to Virginia for about half of what at W&L, and Williamsburg the same thing. I try to talk young people into W&L and they say, yeah, but my father says he can't afford $20,000 a year at W&L when you can't afford $10,000 a year in Virginia. So I just think it was a matter of necessity. And although I was sorry to see it, and my brother in Washington, he just hadn't had anything to do with W&L since then because he dislikes it. So.
Have you been back to campus since co-education?
And I think it seems fine. I'm surprised at the... It seems to me that with the big fraternity houses the boys have, the girls would expect some similar accommodations, and I'm wondering whether that's going to ever become an issue, because...
Oh, it's an issue right now.
I bet it is. Actually, I think the fraternities became a little over-ambitious for a while, and they didn't keep the buildings up the way they should. They were most of them were shambles when I was there. And
you were there as a student?
Yeah. Anyway, I think from all I can see, I know that it's raised the academic standards, and if W&L is a private school, which has to charge more than public schools, is to attract superior young people, it's got to be a highly superior school, and it can be a highly superior school if it has to take people with grade levels that are only mediocre.
Well, those numbers seem to have changed in recent years.
Yeah.
Must be much better.
I see a lot of academics in Williamsburg, good friends of mine, and they say, huh, you want to talk about W&L? Look at our academic, our SATs are so much better than anybody in Virginia but Virginia. And now they don't say that anymore. The chairman of the board of Williamsburg about 6 years ago got some bad information. She said Williamsburg has the highest SATs of any school in the country except Harvard. Well, actually she's had the highest SATs in Virginia, I guess, of any school except Washington Lee and the University of Virginia. But she cuts hold of some wrong dope.
Well, we've gotten through my list of questions. Is there anything more you would like to say?
Well, I have a great respect for the Scotch-Irish who settled the valley, and I think, by and large, the record those people made in colleges and schools was a good one, and Princeton and Davidson and the levels of schools, the Scotch-Irish or the Scottish never were as rich as the English, but they seemed to have put a big emphasis on scholarship and academic work, and I think that shows up in schools like Dr. Tucker used to, the dean at WDL used to say, he didn't think Washington Lee should ever be too rich, he said. He thought that the old saying that the best university was Mark Hopkins at one end of a log and a student at the other had a lot of truth, that that luxurious surroundings, beautiful buildings, expensive trips and so forth were not necessary for education. You got what you had to have, really dedicated profs and dedicated students. Well, I don't know that he'd say that anymore, because education has become a more expensive thing. But, and I do think Dr. Gaines did a great job of establishing a sort of support body for Washington Lee. And I think he had to do that by showing that it was a serious school. When I went to work with Virginius Dabney on the Times-Dispatch, he said, look, Park, everybody knows Washington Lee is a good time school, but we don't think of it as a particular academic school. It was known in Tidewater by a lot of people as a place where people went to fancy dress and things like that. I sometimes wonder whether fancy dress was an asset or a liability. But I think it's taken seriously there. You look at these magazines that attempt to rate schools, and they, most of them seem to think WNL's a very good place.
These days it's way up there, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
I'm very proud to be associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, hope I haven't talked to you to death.
You have not in, at all. You have just done a marvelous interview. I can already see the quotes on the page. Thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome.